Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. When she was 27 years old, Stephanie Saldana thought she'd found her calling. But at a monastery in the Syrian desert, she discovered that calling was something very different than she'd imagined. Stephanie's essay is Signs, Wonders, and Fates Fulfilled. It's read by Linda Cardellini, known for her work in Bloodline, Mad Men, and Freaks and Geeks.
The first time I saw Frederic, he was wearing a long monastic habit and carrying a battered teapot. "Would you like some tea?" he asked. When I said yes, he smiled and lifted the teapot high, tipping it slightly so the tea poured in a long, steaming arc. The man clearly poured a lot of tea. At 27, I had just arrived in Syria on a year-long fellowship to study the Prophet Jesus in Islam. I was living in a dilapidated room in the old city of Damascus, with decaying wooden doors, a non-flushing toilet, and a 73-year-old Armenian neighbor. This was 6 years ago, when refugees from the war in Iraq were flooding the city, and my Arabic studies were progressing at a painfully slow pace. The cacophony of Damascus life exhausted me, not to mention the stream of admonitions from my neighbor. "What? Are you wearing that outside? People can see your legs." "What? You're from Texas? Do you know George Bush?" By the end of the week, I was ready to escape to the desert. The monastery of Deir Marmoussa is perched atop a mountain, and it can be reached only by climbing 350 stairs. The monastery had been built into the cliff some 1,500 years before, and the building occupies a space that appears to be nestled exactly between earth and sky. Soon I was visiting the monastery almost every weekend. Whenever I arrived in the courtyard, that young French novice monk would appear, asking me if I would like some tea. I soon learned that Frederic was in his third and final year of novitiate, having arrived on a journey through the Middle East several years before and more or less staying put. In that time, he had come to look exactly as one might imagine a desert monk to look. He possessed a mane of wild, curly hair, the requisite leather belt and sandals, and hands often swollen from beekeeping. Beyond offering and accepting tea, he and I didn't speak much. He seemed too otherworldly for me, and I had just had my heart broken by a man in Boston, leaving me suspicious of men in general, even novice monks. We became friends only when I decided to become a nun. 2 months after I arrived in Damascus, I left the city for the monastery to undergo the month-long spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius. I spent weeks in silence. I prayed. In my afternoons on top of the desert mountains, I wrestled with a difficult family past, a history of depression, and the feeling of helplessness I experienced when confronting the chaos of a region I had come to love. Finally, I chose to offer up my life to God. In the words of my childhood religion teacher, I decided to help carry the cross. I never knew if God accepted my offer. My body didn't. A few weeks after I decided to become a nun, I grew so sick that it hurt to breathe. I spent 2 weeks in my bed in Damascus waiting to die, allowing my 73-year-old neighbor to ply me with 7-Up, which he insisted could cure any malady, from flu to cancer. My neighbors referred to my illness as the sickness of sadness. When I finally returned to the monastery, Frederic found me sitting alone in the chapel, weak and overwhelmed. He approached quietly and sat near me for a long time. Finally, I began to speak about my month in the desert, about my confusion regarding my decision to become a nun. He listened. Getting up to leave, he said, "I never really thought you should become a nun." "Why?" "Because you don't believe in resurrection." He didn't say it cruelly. In fact, he sounded sad. "What do you mean?" "It's simple, Stephanie. You don't love your life." And I didn't. Not the life I had left behind in America, and not the life I had assumed in Syria. But I wanted to start. That February, in Damascus, I set out in search of beauty. I studied the Quran, pausing to hear the music hidden in the verses. I watched children playing at the Umayyad Mosque at dusk, their bodies glowing golden as the sun set on the marble tiles. I began to speak Arabic, delighting in the cadence of the Syrian dialect. Then on Thursday nights, I traveled to the monastery, where I prayed, walked in the desert, and talked to Frederic. In the beginning, we spoke mostly about God, but we recognized something familiar in each other. Before long, he was telling me about his childhood in Brittany, about his travels in Canada, the Far East, and throughout the Arab world. I told him about sailing the Nile and walking across Spain. One Saturday morning, we sang every Beatles song that we could think of while we washed the dishes. Then we returned to the life of angels, the monastic day that is siphoned off by bells and prayers. That evening after the meditation, when Frederic picked up his guitar to play the hymn before Mass, instead of Alleluia, he played the Beatles' Blackbird. I knew he was telling me a secret. There is no graceful way to fall in love with a man already engaged to God. By April, Frederic and I knew that our relationship had passed the border of friendship. I blamed myself. Was I trying to compete with the divine? Was I temptation embodied like those evil women who seduce monks in the legends of the desert fathers? For his part, Frederic tried to make sense of our relationship from the world in which he lived. "Remember, Stephanie, this is a spiritual love, like the love between St. Francis and St. Clair." But Claire never daydreamed about retiring to a farmhouse in the French Alps with Francis and having three children. "It's clear we're meant to be together," he insisted. "But I've already been called to be a monk. Maybe this is God's way of telling you that you should be a nun after all." But if there was anything that I was certain of now, it was that I was not meant to be a nun. For months, I had agonized over whether or not I had a calling. Yet from the moment I fell in love with Frederic, I had never questioned the truth of my emotions. I knew, for the first time in my life, that a calling felt like this. So I tried to stay away from the monastery. I tried not to influence Frederic in his choice. I even bought him a new monastic belt, as if donating to his ascetic wardrobe would somehow render me guiltless. He called me most evenings. And though we spoke of little other than studies and prayers, we knew that we did not want a day to pass without hearing from each other. One afternoon, he asked me to teach him the Quran. That night, I sat down and opened my Quran to the story of the Prophet Joseph, a mystic, a stranger. He was so beautiful that women who saw him became distracted from their work and cut their hands. His life was suffused with the memory of a night in his childhood when his brothers abandoned him at the bottom of the well. In the moment he lost hope, he received a message telling him the meaning of life. could not tell Frederick I thought he was beautiful. I could not tell him that sometimes the secrets of our lives do not belong to us, but instead are given in the moment we feel abandoned at the bottom of the well. Instead, I sent him the passages on Prophet Joseph. I added a note, saying that it contained the story of a beautiful young man, exiled far from his family, who dreamed great dreams, and through those dreams, understood the world. It was the first love letter I ever sent him. For the next 2 months, Frederick and I courted each other through Quranic love letters. I hoped he would learn about me through the stories that I loved. I waited. I lighted candles. And then felt terrible about asking God for this favor. I tried to study. Most of all, I wrestled with the uncomfortable fact that Frederick was a novice monk who believed deeply in his vocation. But he was also in love with me. It was as though, he told me, he had been given two callings and then asked to do the impossible. Choose between love and love. He decided to ask God to send him a sign. My lasting memory of that summer is of me in a crumbling room in the ancient city and Frederick in the desert, both looking out our windows for signs. For a few weeks, everything became miraculous. Ceramic tiles on an old building, children holding hands. On one of my last days in Syria, Frederick passed me on the stairs of the monastery and handed me a note. Maybe God finally spoke. I met you. I returned to America as planned. And the next month, Frederick traveled to India to make a choice far from the influence of abbots, monks, and me. He wished to be invisible, so he wore his ordinary clothes. In a crowded train station in Mumbai, he boarded a train to Kerala. Soon, the countryside was flying past. He wrote in his notebook, "I can feel a miracle coming." The train slowed at the next station, and two elderly nuns boarded, followed by a young Indian girl. How strange to see them here, he thought. They looked for the number on their ticket. It was next to his seat. The two nuns approached him. "Are you going to Cochin?" they asked. "Yes." "Then can you please take care of her? She's traveling alone." Frederick nodded. It was quiet for a long time. When the train started moving, the girl glanced at him. "Where are you going?" he asked her. "I was a novice in a Carmelite monastery for 3 years," she said. "And now I've decided to leave and return to my family." He looked at her in disbelief for a moment, and then smiled. "Me too," he said. "And now, we are a family."
That's Linda Cardellini reading Stephanie Saldana's piece, Signs, Wonders, and Fates Fulfilled. We'll hear more from Stephanie after the break. Stephanie and Frederick have been married for 11 years now. She's 41 and he's 44, and they live in Jerusalem with their three young children. But Stephanie says that in the beginning, the transition away from the monastery wasn't entirely smooth.
I had this unrealistic expectation that Frederick, after 3 years living in a monastery in the desert, was just going to come into the world and be like anyone else. But the fact is that he was still a novice monk. And we would always joke that God was somehow like the other person in our relationship, that the kinds of things in other marriages that somebody might worry about another woman, that I would find things that would show that he was thinking about God. So sometimes if I was doing the laundry, I would find prayer beads in his pocket. He was always asking to go on retreats, and I would always tease him and say, if you're going to go out on a retreat with God, you need to take me on a date as well. But in time, he never really stopped being a novice monk. He just changed and brought that spiritual life into our marriage.
And when they had children, Stephanie says it showed them a different kind of holiness.
Both of us were drawn to the monastic life. And there can be a kind of perfection which can come with the monastic life, to live like the angels, they would say. And then we came into the world and we had these kids, and our life is just so beautifully messy. And it's the most beautiful thing, and to discover a different kind of sanctity, I would say, in that messiness has been the greatest gift of having a family.
Stephanie and Frederic left the monastery of Deir Marmoussa in 2005. Since then, they've watched the Syrian civil war devastate the country where they first met.
We wish we could go back for an hour, for a day, drink another cup of coffee, be next to the people that we loved, walk in those streets. This country which gave me the man that I love, gave me the Arabic language that I speak every day, gave me my faith in that monastery.
And Stephanie says that although her essay is about her and Frederic falling in love, there's a hidden character who's behind almost every sentence, Father Paolo Dall'Olio.
Father Paolo was the man who built that monastery again. He revived it in the desert. He's the man who sent Frederic off to make that choice in India. He's the man who married Frederic and I. When the war started, he spoke out against the government and was forced out of the country. But exile was very, very difficult for him. And in 2013, he decided to sneak back into the country in order to meet with a man who was still relatively unknown at the time, named al-Baghdadi, and to try to negotiate the release of hostages. And he never returned.
Stephanie says that at first, Father Paolo wasn't eager for her and Frederic to leave the monastery, but he still traveled to France to marry them.
And there are these pictures of me coming down the aisle and my father lifting up the veil. And in the picture, you can see Paolo there, my spiritual father. And you can see my real father, who passed away just the year before Paolo disappeared. And there's a sense that both of them are giving me away. Paolo would say, this is the poverty of the monastic life, is that you love people and yet you let them go to live their lives.
And Stephanie says that the story of the girl Frederic met on the train is something they've come back to again and again.
In the early years, that was really his miracle. But then, in any marriage, there's challenges and difficulties, especially when you're a marriage of two different cultures living in a third culture. We live in Jerusalem. And there were many times when I was having difficulty, and I would tell myself, don't worry, an angel appeared on a train. And so over the years, it was as though that young girl who appeared to him also appeared to me and gave me courage. And so the importance of that moment has somehow only grown over the years.
That's Stephanie Saldana. Her memoir about her life in Syria is called The Bread of Angels. More after the break. Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times, says this essay shows that people look for signs to help them make difficult choices.
The things that help us make these profound choices can be so fleeting and just sort of accidental, and that it really determined the course of our lives. But it needed a nudge. He needed a nudge, or needed something to sort of hang his decision on, because how do you give up one thing you love for another thing you love? How do you make that choice?
And here's Linda Cardellini.
I thought it was so beautiful, and I think there are a lot of mysteries about life, one of those being love and the other being God, and I thought this was an interesting way to speak to both.
Thanks again to Linda for reading this week's piece. Next week, Rachel Weiss.
What once seemed like a bleak choice between losing my soul or losing my most cherished friend was in fact a lesson that true love is the only thing that could save me.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Parati, Caitlin O'Keefe, and Amory Sievertson. Additional sound design by Paul Vikas. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.